Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, the poet Victoria Kenefick wrote a very moving piece recently in the Irish Times, and it was about an experience she went through during lockdown. Her former spouse, whom she knew then as her husband, came out as trans. And Victoria explores this, among other things, in her terrific new poetry collection, Egg/Shell. And she joins me now. Good morning, Victoria.
Good morning, Brendan. Thanks so much for having me.
That's okay. And I want to say about the book that in case people think, God, these sound like really intense poems and everything, they're fantastic and there's great fun in there and there's all human life in there. So look, just to start, for clarity for people, you refer to your former spouse as she, even in the past tense. How did you arrive at that?
It's such an extraordinary cognitive experience, I think, something changing so drastically and someone changing so drastically, as I'm sure many people can relate to in their own lives in different ways. And I think I became really interested in the neuroplasticity of the brain. And so I had to really work on, when my former spouse came out, on changing pronouns, obviously, but also changing her name. And so I think I basically did an extremely good job of that. Because now when I think of our previous relationships, it is her as she is now that is now in those memories. And it's just an extraordinary thing to that my brain was that malleable and adaptable that it did that. And I think it kind of maybe is a coping mechanism too, to avoid confusion, because more than anything, it is an extremely confusing space. For me, at least, and I think for her initially, which I think is very natural and normal.
Totally. Tell me about how you met. You were both at a kind of challenging time in life, I think, were you?
Very much so. My father had been ill for quite a long time with a recurring tumour in the meninges in the lining of his brain. And that's a very disturbing thing to watch because he had numerous surgeries. And so I think I was towards the end of that journey and unfortunately my father's journey, and very coming to the end of my PhD and feeling very, I suppose, vulnerable, and having been in education for most of my life, I'm kind of a bit scared about what was next. And that's when I met her, and she was coming to the end of her PhD and was, I suppose, grappling with her own anxieties. And it was almost like we found each other in this kind of storm of anxiety, really, and held on to each other in that and provided, I suppose, a bit of safety and stability.
Okay, so then we come to the lockdown, the COVID lockdowns, which I think an intense time for everyone, really. Even mentioning it brings people right back there. How did the conversation come about where your former spouse came out to you?
It was such a long process. And I think the actual conversation, in my recollection of it now, was a really beautiful, gentle one. I suppose, like many people during lockdown initially, it was kind of giddy and exciting and terrifying because we were out of our routine. But over time, it became apparent that she was starting to be quite distant and quite reserved and in herself quite a lot. And I asked her how she was and so on. But obviously, we were all going through very interesting times at that point. So it was, I suppose, a way of explaining a lot of discomfort people were feeling at the time. But it was one night. And I think when I think of it now, it was like we let go of the, I suppose, labels that we use of husband and wife and, you know, what does this mean for me and all of that. And I just asked her, you know, are you okay? I am just a human person asking another human person, are you okay? And she told me, and I remember feeling enormous relief, which may sound strange, but that there was something, and now I knew what it was, and now we could move on from that. But also just a huge amount of compassion that she had been grappling with this very significant and life-altering realization by herself, and feeling quite unsure of how to say it to me and come out to me, and then subsequently what would happen afterwards. So it was like this softness, I think. And that's something that I hope in my new book that I'm moving towards as well, a softness around our shared humanity and the fact that we're not perfect, and we're, you know, our lives aren't despite evidence to the contrary, linear. And so things come up and things change us and things help us grow. So it, when I look back on it, I think I'm quite proud of us both in that moment, because there was understanding and compassion. And obviously afterwards, it was a little bit more complicated, but at least there was that moment of, I think, of just acceptance and acknowledgement.
But you must have been shocked, were you?
I was shocked. I was shocked. And I think there was a level of that too, because I remember the next morning, suddenly all of the thoughts racing. Yeah. And I think one of the major questions I had all the time was, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Like, what is the blueprint for this? What is the procedure for this? How does one manage this? And I think so many people feel that when, you know, huge changes happen. And it is a process, and it was messy and it was difficult and it was complicated and it was hilarious at times and really bizarre at other times. And I think shock is something that we need to hold ourselves in and not react to if we can. And I did have moments where I, you know, reacted to it, but equally was aware that this was something that I had to adapt to. And kind of a little bit after this, I realized that I had ADHD. And I think the ADHD brain, one of its benefits is that it's very good at, in a crisis, and it's also very good at adapting. So those two things were maybe useful in that too.
You see, I feel it, this is not fair, but I think I'd be angry and I think I'd be hurt. And I suppose, is there all that as
Of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Let me know.
Okay.
Yes, I am a saint. And I was like completely accepting. Oh, my gosh. Of course I was angry. And of course I was hurt. And I was very confused and annoyed and disgruntled. And my ego was hugely dented.
Yeah. Okay.
Hugely dented. Yeah. And I guess what I realized in that moment, because, I mean, they're normal human emotions, that I didn't want to. I had a moment, I think, and I think it was very much because of my daughter, that I didn't want to let myself down in running away with that. But I had to acknowledge those feelings and work through them, but also work through them myself and not put them on her, on my former spouse, because it wasn't her fault. I mean, she didn't, you know, sign up for this, but I have to kind of process it myself. But yeah, the writing definitely helped in processing those more awkward emotions.
I bet, yeah. Is there a denial as well initially? I mean, it's a lot to take on, is it?
I think so. I think when she came out initially, there was huge, as I say, relief on both our sides that it was out in the open, and then kind of wondering, well, what is she going to do and what are we going to do? And then this kind of holding pattern, I think. And I think, again, that's very much part of how people process information. We had this kind of delusional time, which was not unpleasant, where she was kind of exploring where she would go with this and how far she would go, or what she needed. And I was kind of distracted by my first book, and really excited about how that was taking off. And so we were kind of like on our own little paths.
Yeah.
And then around Christmas, it became apparent that maybe that wasn't necessarily going to work out in the long term. And then we had another chat. So there were a series, I suppose, of those kind of state of the nation addresses.
Yeah. So, there's a line in one of the poems, "Who Am I Now Without You?" And like, you must be thinking, okay, that's her journey and good for her. But like, what am I going to do now? What happens to me?
Absolutely. And again, that's okay. And I think we all, I think probably there was a level of relief in focusing on her experience and not thinking too much about myself, which I think maybe a lot of people can relate to. But when I did think of myself, I did have to confront the fact that this was massively disappointing. This was not what I signed up for when I walked up the aisle with this person whom I deeply cared for. But that's life also. And I think maybe more than anything, and this was really challenging, was not taking it personally. Like, she wasn't doing it to me. It was really difficult for her to do. It was, as you say, it was her journey. And I could attach myself to that and be very angry and bitter. And I understand if people are in that place. But I didn't want to live my life like that. And I didn't want my child to grow up with that kind of experience. And, you know, if love is anything, it's acceptance. And maybe my love altered and changed for this person, and it's grown in different ways and maybe become dormant and kind of withered away in other ways. But it's very much the idea that if you love someone, and I mean like, you know, love in its widest sense, you accept them as they are, but also you accept yourself as you are. So loving my anger and disappointment and going, that's, you know, that's a normal feeling to have. It's okay. It will pass. And again, the writing.
You kept loving her as well. And she's the same person in essence to you.
Yeah, that's a really, I'm still learning about that. Yeah. Because obviously, I think she's maybe 2 years into her transition now, and such a wonderful woman and a brilliant parent. And I appreciate her friendship so much, and her generosity and graciousness around me writing the book and around my writing journey. And she's been so supportive and accepting of me being on national radio talking about it. So we've given each other, I think, a lot of freedom and a lot of rope. And I think our initial coming together maybe facilitated us growing in the ways that we needed to grow, that we were maybe afraid of growing separately. And in that growing away from each other in particular ways, but ultimately being a very, very nourishing experience. So I think she accepts me as much as I accept her. And that's, I think, what the beauty is of this experience.
So you said about that other conversation at Christmas, and by the way, I think you're big enough and bold enough to tell me at any point.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely bold. I'm from Cork, Brendan.
So the conversation at Christmas then, that was about making some hard decisions.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the more practical decisions around, you know, I think initially, and I can't speak for her or anyone in that position, but it looked like to me that she was very much realizing that what she needed and who she was to be a woman and to be recognized in society and in her family and by other people as the woman that she was and is. And that meant that there was no middle ground or there was no alternative. And I couldn't live. I mean, we had such, like, they were hilarious because we did end up laughing about them. We had conversations about, you know, could you part-time, you know, live as this person? And it became more insane because why would anyone do that to themselves? And why would a relationship take precedence over somebody's authenticity and their need to be who they are? That sacrifice to me is not, it's not love, and it's not being your full self. And then how can you be in a relationship with somebody who's not being their full self? So it meant a lot of very big changes and a lot of hard decisions. But I think that it all happened slowly and messily and chaotically and hilariously and tragically. But I think those kind of milestones were very important on the road to kind of the other side, which hopefully we're on now.
So this might sound ridiculous in a way, but it took you a while. Did it take you a while to go, we're splitting up here? Like, yeah,
I think so, because it's, and again, this is only my experience, but it was my, at the time, husband telling me this. But she still looked and sounded and acted like my husband. And so it was very confusing to go, well, you still are the same. So how is that going to happen physically and emotionally and psychologically? So I think it was a very gradual letting go. I think it was a very gentle letting go. And I remember so distinctly, and this is a really interesting memory for me in terms of what masculinity means and what femininity means for me. Yeah. I remember coming down the stairs one morning, and she was, you know, had started her transition and was a little bit down the road. And I was like, I could hear her in the kitchen, and I was like, there's no man in this house. I don't feel that energy, whatever masculine energy feels like to me or whatever it felt like in the house. Yeah. It was absent. And I was like, that's extraordinary. Like, that person's energy or whatever she was, maybe it's a physical thing, maybe it's a hormonal thing, I don't know, but it was gone. And there was a very, very significant and obvious feminine energy in the room. And I was like, oh, she's here. And whatever that was has integrated into this person or has gone or something. And it was just, it was amazing. Like, I have to say, as somebody who researches as a coping mechanism and who intellectualizes way too much as a coping mechanism, intellectually and cognitively, it is a fascinating experience.
Yeah,
really, really fascinating.
Yeah. So tell me about your research and how it helped you and everything.
I think I really do go to, you know, the library and Google and try and find out as much as I can about any subject that I suppose I find difficult to grapple with more emotionally. And one of the things I found out that really helped me with my book, which initially I suppose was about secondary infertility, which is something I shamefully didn't really realize was such a huge experience that people shared until it kind of visited my door, which I think is often the case with such experiences.
What is it?
It's basically when you experience fertility issues after having a very easy, quote unquote, pregnancy with your first child or second child. It can happen at any time, but usually it's you have a first child without incident or difficulty and then have subsequent problems afterwards. So I was looking at the egg, I suppose, as a symbol of that and as a metaphor for fertility and for difficulties around that and the potential of the egg and what it can become or not become. And when I was researching the trans experience, because I really wanted to understand what she was going through and I really wanted to help, but also find some sort of way of understanding it for me, I came across this wonderful fact, I think I can call it a fact, where in the trans community, somebody who hasn't realized that they're trans is called an egg. And then when they have the beautiful epiphany that they are a trans person, their egg cracks. So there is mess, there is something breaks, but equally something wonderful and useful and interesting and bigger comes out of that. So I found that, I suppose, as a poet who thinks in metaphor and understands the world in imagery, that was so helpful.
Let's have a poem, will we? Changing her name on your phone was a big thing for you. Do you want to? You talked about that neuroplasticity and everything. Do you want to explain it first, or will you just read the poem?
I can just give very brief context, because I think in a story like this, I think perhaps people might think, as I would, listening to your show, eating my porridge as I usually am at home in Kerry, think it's very dramatic. But it's actually a series of very small changes, and I remember changing the name in my phone to my co-parent's new name, her real name, and way before she came out to anybody else, because I felt I had to be ready and sure and not make mistakes. And oh my goodness, I was so shocked that for weeks and weeks and weeks, I kept on being surprised by this name, not knowing who it was. Lessons in neuroplasticity when changing your name to your name. The telephone is torture. When I call you, I hear you still as you were on your voicemail, and my brain persists in thinking nothing has changed. I update to your new name in my contacts. It is a shock every time you call. Who is she?
That kind of, it's funny how poetry can kind of explain much, much more. And
it's a relief, I often find.
Yeah, yeah. How do you reflect on your relationship with your co-parent now, given everything you've been through?
I think it has been an enormous gift to bear witness to somebody moving into their authenticity when it is terrifying and shocking to other people and awkward and in a culture and society that is hostile to that for many reasons that are quite sad. And so what I found is that I learned that love is huge and expansive and different, and it isn't connected to ego. And it really is about allowing and accepting someone as they are. And in doing that, as much as I could for her, I actually had to start doing that for myself. And that's when I think I realized that I needed help with my ADHD brain and needed to acknowledge that that was the type of brain I had and get a bit of help with that and maybe move more into opening my heart up in my work and in my poetry and in my life in general, accepting my, I suppose, the parts of myself that I had locked away that I thought were too much or difficult for other people to manage or were too vulnerable or sensitive. Like having been called too sensitive my whole life, it was something I always tried to hide extremely badly, and just going, yeah, I'm actually very sensitive. And that's maybe a positive thing and it has a purpose, and maybe someone else isn't. And that's a really positive thing and has a purpose because we all have our little roles. And when we step into them, I think that's when real transformation happens. And what I've noticed is the more I step into this, not without trepidation, not without fear, not without residual, you know, anger and confusion and so on occasion, but people respond to it and step into their own acceptance and their own sensitivity as well. And I think that can only be a good thing. So I'm really grateful. So
you're cracking eggs. Cracking for eggs everybody, all over the left, place. Right, and centre. And listen, had you known or suspected you had ADHD? Does this all happen?
Yeah, it was a heady time. It's sure all or was. Nothing with me, Brendan. Seriously, go big or go home. I think with ADHD and it's an extraordinary area, especially, I suppose, for women, because it was very much obviously focused on young boys when I was growing up that they were, you know, running on a motor and so on. But women often present as inattentive. So daydreamers and kind of airy fairy people around the place who talk too much. And I think I was always extremely good at standing on a stage and in exams or in interviews because I was so clear of what my purpose was in that. It was like very clear, very clean, if that makes sense.
So but what hyper-focus.
Hyper-focus, right. Exactly. And like, you know, time limits and structure and it's imposed on you. So that's why I think stayed in education for so long in many respects. But things like doing the laundry or packing, oh my God, or cooking dinner or anything that was a day-to-day routine activity, I really struggled with, like doing my homework. I do my English homework, you know, and do it like intensely and really focus for hours. And then everyone would be out playing and I'd be just sitting with my maths homework, just daydreaming and talking to myself.
So is it helpful now to have that label? Does it help you understand yourself better? Yet?
It really does. And I think people can be quite get upset around labels. And I appreciate that. But for me, I suppose growing up feeling quite ashamed around the fact that I found normal everyday things extremely challenging and upsetting, and that I couldn't do them as efficiently or organize myself. Like my executive function is really affected by it and my working memory, which is really helpful to learn that I have like this black hole, a vortex in the center of my brain that doesn't know where my keys are always. And it's not my fault. It's just the way my brain is organized. So I think knowing that it is just the way my brain is a huge liberation for me because I'm not blaming myself or punishing myself or embarrassed or like I'm literally talking about it again on national radio, which is something I could never have considered, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. So I think it can be a really positive, empowering thing.
So how is the co-parenting working now? And allied to that, do you have to go around explaining your family to everyone all the time?
That's a really fascinating area because I have such empathy for families that are different, quote unquote, again, in any way, because there is this sense of, I suppose, a family being the traditional one of mother, father, usually more than one child, dog, perhaps. But I think it can be, it's something I have to challenge in myself to not over-explain. And I think that can be an ADHD trait as well, to over-explain. So I'm trying not to, but I do feel like I want to, that I want to kind of cut off any questions at the pass and protect my daughter maybe from questions and make her realize that this is a normal version of a family. You know, all families come in all different shapes and sizes, but I do find that occasionally something that is challenging.
What would you like people to take away from the book? Is also about fertility and the ADHD is in there as well. But what would you like people to take away from this conversation and from this aspect of the poems?
What would I like people to take away? I think ultimately, and hopefully I achieve this to some degree in my poems, but I think it all comes down to, and it sounds so cliched in many ways, but that's why cliches exist, I suppose, is really actually loving all the aspects of yourself, and especially those contradictory ones, or those ones that you're afraid of or that you're ashamed of, and letting them be in your body and letting them be in your heart and listening to what they have to say to you. And I think sometimes when we resist something, that is the very thing that we need to accept. And in letting go, there is a beautiful, extremely joyful, liberated future ahead for everybody in the letting go of resistance to what is.
Stop. You'll have people crying, you know. I'm nearly crying.
I cry all the time, every day. It's very important.
There's lots of really supportive texts and people getting a lot out of this incredible, beautiful interview. Holy moly, such an open heart. Another person said like that it is a horrific experience. Their partner is transitioning after 30 years. It's horrific. The loss, not just of the marriage, the person I loved, the questioning, the kids trying to work it out. It's not always as easy as wonderful as Victoria said. You're not saying it's easy.
I'm very, and my heart goes out to that person and to the person transitioning and to their children. And it's not easy. It's not easy. And life is not easy. And I think there is a huge amount of power in accepting that, and it's really painful. And so, like, life is painful and life is suffering. And I suppose it's maybe when you can and if you're able to find what that can open up for you.
Okay. And look, lots of other warm texts. Look, there are texts, as you can imagine as well, from people who fundamentally disagree with the concept of transitioning as well.
And I send them my best wishes and hope they will be okay and mind themselves.
Okay, so we're going to finish on a poem, Swan Song. Before we do that, there's a poem that's just one line. Have you got it handy there? Do you know it off the top of your head? Halloween,
yeah.
Best poem ever.
Thank you so much. I'm very much a believer in humour and in humour in sometimes the darkest of times, because it really, like, taking things lightly is such a huge and radical step, but it really does help in trying to manage the crazy experience of being alive. Halloween. Please don't egg my house. Can't you see I'm already walking on eggshells?
Brilliant. We all get that one. Okay, so the book is called Eggshell. It's published by Carcanet Press. Victoria Kenefic, thank you so much. Thank you so much for that. And will we finish so on a poem? And this is a poem called Swan Song.
Swan Song. It's nighttime. We hold hands, peer into the hole we dug together. Into it we place our marriage, the full shape of it, moonshiny. An egg, the seed we have tended for so long, now we must bury it. We are both crying, of course, but it must be done. We pat the earth with the flat of our hands, imagining each other's backs. A bald, featherless patch on the grass. You sing, even so, our little song. The mute swans stay mute.
You okay?
All good.
Victoria
Kenefic,
thank you so much. We'll take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.